Senator Putnam, are you ready? Order this hearing of the Senate Tax Committee. We have the minutes in front of you. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, the minutes stand approved as presented. The first bill before us today is Senate File 1879. Senator Putnam. Wait for him to get settled.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I'm excited to have the opportunity to present for your consideration Senate File 1879, which would renew and expand Minnesota's beginning farmer tax credit. First, I'd like to move the A2 amendment, if I may, Madam Chair.
The A2 amendment is before us. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Putnam, would you just say what the amendment, the impact the amendment had?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The member amendment basically just clarifies the definition of family member for the sale to whom the credit would be allowed.
Okay, and that comes on that comes at page 3, line 1. And what can you tell us what that means? What does that add?
Madam Chair, it just is a little bit more precise about what a family member can be and what a family member means and the relationship between the family member and the seller or renter.
Okay.
That language was in the initial document as well. This just makes it a little bit more clear.
I see. Okay. All right. Senator Putnam, proceed with your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members for listening to this incredibly important issue. Now, we all know that farming is capital intensive. Land, equipment, livestock, they're all expensive. And that creates real challenges for young people and others who want to get started in agriculture. We also know that farmers are aging out of this profession and lifestyle. We need to help new people farm. Now, we all know this, but I heard this concern clearly and emphatically expressed in the farmer town halls that I've held in the last couple months. I heard about this in Piers. I heard about this in Chatfield, and I heard about this in Faribault. Farmers are anxious about the future of agriculture for our economy, for their families, and for the culture that agriculture grows. This bill hears those concerns. This law provides existing farmers an incentive to rent or sell agricultural assets to beginning farmers, helping them buy land, broker relationships, and get established in their operations. Now, to walk through the bill itself. Section 1 amends Subdivision 2 of Minnesota Statute Section 41B to define the program and makes clear the amount of the credit and who is qualified for it. Section 2 amends Subdivision 4 of Minnesota Statute Section 41B to make explicit the amount to be granted and that unused funds would be rolled over into subsequent years. Section 3 amends Subdivision 4 of Minnesota Statute Section 41B to make explicit the requirements of a report to the legislature that would document the administration of the program. Section 4 repeals the sunset of the program. Now, members, that's the structure of the bill. But this is its meat. This is how it will matter to farmers. First and most importantly, as I just suggested, the bill would eliminate the sunset of the program. Without our action, this credit will expire in December of this year. Second, the bill would increase the credit for sale of agricultural assets from 5 to 8% and up the limit to $50,000. Members, this is not a new program. But one of the things that we've discovered through the administration of this program is that farmers are more likely to participate in the rental component than the sale component. And we all know, with the cost of land these days and the importance of building equity, that it's we have a compelling interest in incentivizing the sale component of this legislation. So secondly, this credit would increase, this bill would increase the credit for the sale of agricultural assets from 5 to 8% and up the limit to $50,000. Third, for socially disadvantaged farmers, black, indigenous farmers of color, this bill would increase the credit for sale of ag assets to 12%. Now, to be very clear, The language that we're using here is socially disadvantaged farmers. That's federal language from the USDA that reflects a history of excluding, explicitly excluding certain populations. So if, say, 50 years ago, USDA had a thing that said, if you're black, you can't apply for this fund, explicitly, that counts as a socially disadvantaged farmer. Now, if these populations have been, and they have been, explicitly excluded in our history, this is a mere simple opportunity to compensate for that exclusion. Again, this is not only the morally right thing to do, it's actually the rational one to do. Now, fourth and finally, my bill would expand this credit to family members for sale of ag land. But one of the things that I've heard in my conversations with farmers over the years is this frustration when it comes to intergenerational transfer. How can someone pass on their land to their kids? In the past, the Beginning Farmer Sales Credit, tax credit did not allow for that. This is fixing that problem. Now, all these changes are made within the current funding cap of $6 million a year, with the remainder rolling forward. We've also retained the credit for beginning farmers to pay for farm business management courses and have maintained income limitations under the original bill. Now, finally, and before I turn over to testifiers, I want to highlight that 19 agricultural organizations have signed on a letter in your packet to support these changes. These are folks who don't necessarily agree on a lot of stuff, but they agree that this is a good idea. It's a testament to the values of this credit, and I'm eager to carry it forward to the next generation of farmers in our state. And with that, Madam Chair, I turn to my testifiers, if I may.
Thank you very much. excuse me, Senator Putnam. Mr. Peterson, the commissioner, and I guess we're having one person testify remotely. Commissioner Peterson, welcome to the committee. We look forward to your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, Tom Peterson, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and just really here today to talk about the importance of the Beginning Farmer Credit. Appreciate Senator Putnam carrying this important piece. I can remember where I was sitting in this room, and I think it was 2017 when this bill passed, and sitting with a lot of young farmers and thinking about the importance of it. And I always remember, too, the fiscal note at that time said that it would benefit about 400 farmers a year. And I thought, that's high. Sorry, Department of Revenue. But I wondered if that would be true. And it was. In fact, we serve almost 1,100 transactions a year in some years in all across the state. In fact, I just looked this last week, Southwest Minnesota, with land prices, is one of the biggest users of this. And so really great to see the importance that this credit has played in the department. It's really important as we look at ag land transfer and asset transfer in the next 20 years. It's estimated that 50% of all the land in Minnesota will change hands just because of the demographics that we have with our population in our state. And so I do believe that the credit's been working very well. We're ready to update the credit. Looking at these changes, we feel that we can work with the author, the Department of Revenue, to make these changes and that they're necessary, and it's what we've heard from people. I'll also say that the credit works in what I've seen with farmers. I've had many farmers come up to me and say they were able to get that parcel of land because of the credit, and because they were bidding against somebody, that the credit was an incentive that helped them attain that. And then keep in mind, back to the point, you know, in a population of 5.7 million people, that we have 67,000 farm families in the state. And so it's not always just about the farm, but the farmers. And so who's going to farm our land in those next 20 years? And so as this Department of Agriculture, we have a beginning farmer loan program. We have a land access down payment assistance program. We have our FarmLink program. This is probably one of the most important pieces and tools that Minnesota has that we can use to help keep farmers on the farm in those next and beginning farmers. So with that too, I also have staff with us that administer the program if you have questions that I can't answer, and I appreciate your opportunity and consideration for this bill.
Is she testifying?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Are there questions or comments for the Commissioner? We have one person then additionally testifying remotely, Molly Byron. Ms. Byron, are you with us?
Thank you, Chair Rest and members of the committee, and thank you to Senator Putnam for his leadership on this proposal. For the record, my name is Molly Byron, and it is my dream to transition my family farm located in Waseca, Minnesota, to the next generation. On behalf of myself and Minnesota Farmers Union, I'm here to testify in strong support to expand and improve access to the Beginning Farmer Tax Credit, allowing family members to participate and utilize the credit. I also support increasing the credit for emerging farmers who often aren't coming into a family operation. This will give them an added leg up and help them get more new farmers on the land. I come from a multi-generational farm family where I'm part of the sixth generation to grow up on my family farm. However, I didn't always know that I wanted to transition my farm. When the pandemic hit in 2020, I found myself back home on the farm after living out of state for 10 years. I ended up reconnecting with my agriculture roots and enrolled in farm business management at South Central College to learn how to manage my family farm while also utilizing the Farm Business Management Scholarship for beginning farmers. I am now in my third year of the program and a member of the South Central College's Farm Business Management Advisory Board. Through this experience, I have had the opportunity to personally hear from farm business management instructors across the state about how much the Beginning Farm Tax Credit has changed the playing field for new and young farmers they work with. The Beginning Farm Tax Credit has become so critical to farm. Today, it is nearly impossible to buy land without some kind of assistance. Young people just can't compete, and this bleeds into our rural communities, affecting businesses and our schools. And there are so many young farmers in Minnesota who wish to transition their generational family farm, but right now do not have the same opportunity for assistance. In most cases, we cannot afford to transition our farms by ourselves. Expanding the Beginning Farm Tax Credit could potentially alleviate farmland from going on the market for sky-high prices because more would consider and actually could take over a family farm. Just last month, I attended a two-day multi-generational farm transition retreat at South Central College with my family. And at this retreat, the room was completely filled with other farm families from across Minnesota. The facilitator shared that this was the largest group of families they've ever had in the over 10 years they have been hosting this retreat, and even had to stop advertising their retreat because they ran out of space. So I am not alone, and there are so many farm families just like my own. Right now, I honestly don't know if I'll be able to financially transition my family farm, and that reality is extremely overwhelming. But this is the reality for most farm families in Minnesota who have hopes of finding a way to continue their farm beyond the current generation. Thank you for the opportunity to share my support and that of Minnesota Farmers Union, Minnesota Farm Bureau Farm Credit, who writes loans to farmers participating in the program, an array of agricultural organizations who've signed on to the letter in your packet. Thank you for your support of Beginning Farmers. I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Byron. Are there comments or questions for her? Seeing none, thank you very much. Senator Putnam, would you like to make a closing comment?
Thank you, members, for listening to me and for your care, for understanding how tax policy impacts people's actual lives. And thank you also to Senators Weber, Dziedzic, Dornick, and Frantz for their current and past support, even Frantz, for their current and past support of this legislation.
Thank you very much, Senator Putnam. Senator Skowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this a refundable or non-refundable credit?
Senator Putnam, the looking at the revenue estimate, I direct your attention to that. Senator Druskowski. The credit is non-refundable. If you look on the revenue estimate, that is current law, and I don't see in that a change in it. However, the bill does repeal the sunset It was due to expire after tax year 2023, so it'll be ongoing. Is that correct, Senator Putnam? Ongoing, but remains non-refundable, so it's a credit against taxes, but not beyond that. Senator Drazkowski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Putnam, for the bill. Senator, I understand the discussion you had about socially disadvantaged farmers, and I don't have any issues with including that language in the report that you got in the bill to make certain that we are doing a good job of making certain that everyone is included in this program, regardless of what they look like or where they come from or what their history is. I do, however, wonder about the idea of, based on people's background, giving people a different tax rate. I think we should treat everybody the same. I mean, what is the motivation for treating people differently because they're of one ethnic group or another?
Senator Putnam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Drazkowski, I appreciate that question. And this could be a very long conversation. But I will say just at the outset that we're not necessarily treating people differently because of their ethnic origin. We're treating them differently because of a history of explicitly denying them access to resources. So there's a distinction here between what you might say being like ethnic studies in higher education or E12 education, because that is largely based on a cultural identification. This is based specifically on articulate policies of the past and the present. I mean, seriously, we like to think of segregation being something from the ancient past. But we had laws that restricted black land ownership up into the 70s. There are people who are still alive today who couldn't buy a house because the neighborhood was redlined. That's not history. That's today. And so, Senator Drazkowski, I would ask you, we have a situation here where we have this crisis in land ownership and agriculture. We basically have two paths forward. We can find a way so that a father can leave the son to the land to his daughter, or so that a retiring farmer can help facilitate the purchase of land by a black family from Minneapolis. We can do that, or we can let our land be purchased by Bill Gates in Beijing, because that's what we're looking at here. This is an opportunity to inspire Minnesotans to become agriculturally invested, to build equity, and to change lives. And this is really important. It's not just on who they are, it's on what was done. This is policy to policy, not personhood or identity.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Putnam, I agree with you on one thing. This could be a very long discussion if we wanted to let it be that. And I don't intend for that. Unfortunately, we see this appears to be a reparations type approach in an agricultural bill, and I know the majority is doing that. And there's huge disagreement with many members about that approach, but that's what you have in the bill. And you know, I haven't studied what you're talking about, the language that appeared in 1970. I'd be interested in reading more about that. But if indeed there was language that discriminated against people in 1970 in the federal language that you talked about, that was not the person who's applying today. That was not the person, whether they're black or white or any other color, green or purple or whatever color they might be. Those were different people back then than today. And these are young farmers. We have a chance to go forward and bring people together in this state or further divide them. And when you treat groups differently, you further divide them. So I don't intend to inspire a long conversation, but that's my take on it. And thanks again for the bill.
Senator Putnam.
Oh, Madam Chair. I should probably apologize before I begin this answer. This is actually what I do. I teach this stuff. And I could tell you of any number of laws that discriminate between different populations. For example, this law makes a division between older people and younger people, between people who have farmed and who haven't farmed. It's naive to think that that laws don't articulate to specific populations because every law does, whether that law is articulated to a citizen or a non-citizen. That's just reality. This isn't about some ideological agenda, and this is not reparations by any stretch of the imagination, nor is that the agenda of the DFL majority. Reparations is something very specific. This is not that. And I think when we talk about issues like this, we need a little bit more precision. And I'm totally willing to have a conversation with you in the future going forward, because I think it would be edifying for both of us.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I would just, what I'll do is I'll send around to everyone in the committee or ask our staff to do so, a report that came from our own Department of Agriculture just as recently as last year that said that there is, for minority farmers, especially those who are trying to start out, they still struggle to serve those, as does the U.S. Department of Agriculture, because of some of the historical nature of how they've been treated, which means that their access to capital, their lack of legal protections in the form of wills, the lack of ability to benefit from land transfers and the like, has made a lot of folks in minority and ethnic minority communities ineligible or not able to access some of the programs as they're currently established. So, you know, there is some remedy in that's manifested in today and in farmers who are trying to start out today. And so I thank Senator Putnam for the recognition of that fact in his bill. And I'll send that report. Just came last year from our own Department of Agriculture to us.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Thank you very much, Senator Putnam, for your presentation. And Senate File 1879 as amended will be laid over. The next bill before us is Senator Klein, Senate File 543. Senator Klein, shall we, I guess it's 453, so, shall we add the amendment first? Senator Klein moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Klein, could you just momentarily explain what the amendment did and then proceed to describing your bill?
Gladly, Madam Chair. So Senate File 453, thank you, committee, for hearing it. Will increase the income level of eligibility for the property tax deferral from $60,000 to $96,000. However, the bill, as introduced, did not include the corresponding income increases found in three other sections related to excess income certification, resumption of eligibility, and determination by the Commissioner of Revenue. The A1 simply clarifies in other sections of law these changes in income amounts, so it draws that in.
Okay, are there questions, comments at this point for Senator Klein? We have one person testifying. If he would come forward now, Mr. Hilgart from the Association of Minnesota Counties. Welcome to the committee, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties, an association representing all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I want to thank Senator Klein and many members of this committee for their support and authorship of Senate File 453. As we've testified before in front of this committee, property tax relief is a top priority for the Association of Minnesota Counties. We've talked at length in this committee about historic residential market value increases, diminishing or eroding tax bases, and inflationary pressure on homeowners. We know seniors are particularly impacted by these trends because of an assortment of issues related to limited income, rising health care and prescription costs, and the inability to respond to inflation and more. In fact, in 2019, Wilder research said the number of homeless seniors was rising at a pace faster than any other group. From 2014 to 2016, the rate of homeless seniors increased by 20% in the state of Minnesota. Not only is senior housing security the right thing to do, it's the economical thing to do for our social safety net systems and for our healthcare systems. Most importantly, we know that dignified living and the ability to age in place transfer into better health outcomes. I want to thank Senator Klein for the small but very impactful bill today that would strengthen what AMC considers a very meaningful option for seniors while not shifting the burden to other families or seniors in the community. AMC has had this mechanism on our platform for several years. It was actually offered by a Olmsted County commissioner, and we are extremely passionate about trying to get this passed this year. So thank you, Senator Klein and others, and we stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgard. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Hilgard or for Senator Klein about Senate File 453? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Klein, I just thank you for bringing this bill. Again, this was part of our conference committee report last year, and seniors are waiting for this. It's very thoughtful. Much needed bill, and I appreciated the testimony as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. No further discussion. Senate File 453, as amended, will be laid over. The next bill in front of us is also authored by Senator Klein, Senate File 2443. Senator Klein.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for hearing Senate File 2443, and I do not have any amendments. Senate File 2443 amends our current pass-through entity tax legislation. The 2021 tax bill established a pass-through entity tax that allows pass-through businesses to elect to pay state income tax at the entity level and then deduct the tax for federal income tax purposes, and that filing option essentially provides pass-through entities an avenue to avoid the $10,000 SALT cap. This bill would require 100% of a resident pass-through entity owner's income to be used in the calculation of the tax, which would increase the total tax and credit for resident owners. It also allows tiered pass-through entities to elect to file and pay the tax, removes the requirement that owners be subject to the federal SALT deduction cap, and sunsets the tax when the SALT deduction cap expires, which is currently 2025. Bill also allows multi-level partnerships, LLCs, or corporations to be qualifying entities as long as they are not a publicly traded partnership. I will anticipate Senator Nelson's suggestion and reminder that this was included in last year's conference committee report. There is a revenue estimate that shows unknown revenue impact, Madam Chair. And
it's the best kind.
What's
unknown?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Those are the types of numbers we love here in the Taxes Committee. Madam Chair, that is the bill. And I have a testifier. So.
Thank you. thank you, Senator Klein. Before we get to the testifiers, are there any questions about any section of the bill that you'd like more explanation for anyone? Okay, then let's proceed to the testifiers. Mr. John Reynolds. And Gino Frignito can also come up and join Senator Klein.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, we welcome your testimony.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm John Reynolds, the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB represents over 10,000 small businesses in every corner of the state. We supported the initial creation of the pass-through entity tax in 2021, and we're pleased to support Senator Klein's bill today, which is an important update that will help many small businesses across the state maximize their federal deduction. So thank you to Senator Klein for carrying the bill, and thank you for your co-authorship, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson. As you probably know, most businesses in the state are very small businesses. 85% of all employers have fewer than 20 employees, and 79 to 96% of pass-through entities, depending on the type, have fewer than 20 employees. So this bill is one of many low-cost or no-cost ways that the committee can reduce the tax burden for small businesses at a time when many are struggling to make ends meet. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions or comments for Mr. Reynolds? Mr. Fragnito?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gino Fragnito, the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota CPA Society, and thank you to Senator Klein for carrying this bill. We have been involved in the conversation since the bill was passed in 2021 as well, and the language in this bill is identical, as Senator Klein said, to what we passed last year, or what was discussed last year, not necessarily passed. And this is a rare opportunity for the state of Minnesota to provide some tax relief to small businesses who are struggling on Main Street, and to treat those Main Street businesses in a similar tax fashion to a type of a benefit that a Wall Street or a C Corp would get. And so this puts some parity there, allows them some additional tax relief, and would also not cost the state any money. So to sum it up, I guess the CPAs are certainly working with many of those businesses and see the struggles that they are facing as they're trying to still continue to rebuild coming out of COVID, and this would be an added benefit and a great relief for those businesses. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Fragnito? We have one person asking to testify remotely, Mr. Joseph Schwartz. Mr. Schwartz, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, we welcome your testimony.
Thank you. Yeah, for the record, my name is Joseph Schwartz, Director and Counsel of Managed Funds Association, or MFA. MFA represents the alternative asset management industry and its investors, which across Minnesota deliver for Minnesota retirees, students, and nonprofits through roughly $36.8 billion in investments, and for Minnesota businesses through roughly $10.6 billion in private credit. Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, and honorable members of the committee for the opportunity to present testimony in support of Senate File 2443's proposed enhancements to the Minnesota pass-through entity tax, the language of which, as noted prior, is identical to the same proposed enhancements included in last session's omnibus tax bill. I would also like to again thank the Department of Revenue for working and meeting with us in the last legislative session to find a solution which both enhances federal tax outcomes for Minnesotans and reduces administrative burdens for taxpayers and the department alike. As previously discussed, this legislation provides two technical amendments to the elective pass-through entity tax, a state revenue neutral measure which shifts the imposition of tax from an individual business owner to the entity through which they conduct their business. In doing so, it allows the individuals to deduct for federal income tax purposes the full share of state taxes paid as a result of recognizing income from their business. These elected business pass-through entity taxes are now pretty much common among states as a response to federal legislation enacted in 2017, which limits the deductibility of state taxes for federal income tax purposes to $10,000. Roughly 30 states have enacted pass-through entity taxes, and since speaking to this committee a couple months ago in January, Indiana has enacted, and West Virginia and Kentucky have sent to their executives pass-through entity taxes which feature Senate File 2443's enhancements, including that each of these pass-through entity taxes apply beginning with January 1st, 2022. It's important not to understate the impact that an optimized pass-through entity tax can have on Minnesota residents. According to information published by the Department of the Treasury, in 2017, the last year in which the federal deduction for state taxes paid was not limited, Minnesotans claimed an aggregate federal deduction for state taxes of roughly $13.7 billion. In 2018, the first year in which the federal deduction for state taxes was limited, that number fell to only $2.7 billion. In other words, assuming that the average effective federal tax rate for Minnesotans claiming this deduction falls somewhere between the 10 and 37% mark, the limitation on the deductibility of state taxes amounted to between a $1.1 billion and $4.1 billion cash tax hit to Minnesotans' pocketbooks in 2018 alone, with similar results expected to follow in each of the subsequent years. Some of that amount certainly was and is at the expense of small and medium-sized business owners for which a fully optimized pass-through entity tax would have provided and still could provide much needed relief given the current state of the economy. With that, you know, we give our full-throated endorsement to this legislation and welcome any questions from the committee.
Any questions or comments for the testifier? Seeing none, Thank you very much, sir. Senator Klein, any final comment or anything?
Thank you to the committee.
Thank you very much. Then Senate File 2443 is laid over. You know, at the rate we were going, we could hear 20 more bills. We should have. We missed an opportunity here. But anyway, maybe you'll have more to say about the next three.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Rest. Senate File 2729 is in front of us.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Senate File. Senate File 2729 modifies or changes the definition of a resident trust, and I draw your attention to the effect of changing that to the revenue estimate, and why I think they're helpful, in addition to the summary of the bill, is because it points out generally, and that's what I'm going to use today. It points out what current law is, and then how it's the revenue estimate then includes then another section about how it's proposed to be changed. So I think these are very helpful for us. And what's being proposed is retaining the definition of a resident trust, which is in the first couple of paragraphs, and then for the pre-1996 trusts, and then applies a similar definition for the post-1995 trusts. And this is a very complicated part of the law. I'm not an expert in it, and I'm going to ask the testifier, if he would, to help us get through this and instruct all of us.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Mr. Sampson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Michael Sampson. I'm a partner at the law firm of Maslin LLP in Minneapolis, and I've been practicing in trust and estates law for 25 years. Senator Rest, you're correct. This is a very complicated area of the law. The current statute is unworkable for practitioners. And this proposal is a welcome and, I think, much-needed improvement. In July of 2018, the Minnesota Supreme Court decided in the Fielding case that Minnesota's current statute was unconstitutional when it applied to taxpayers like the ones before it in that case, where the only contacts with Minnesota were the residency of the grantor at the time the trust became irrevocable. First of all, they said you have to look at the tax year in question. That's much more important than what happened when the trust was originally created. 5 years later, the resident trust statute still hasn't been changed. The Fielding case is still out there. And as a fellow practitioner says, you shouldn't have to be a constitutional scholar to file your taxes. And I think that's true. This uncertainty benefits the Department of Revenue. Because it's not clear whether you have to file your tax return or not, they say, well, then file it. And we'll tell you whether it's taxable or not. And if you choose not to file, you could be assessed with penalties and interest for making what you believe is a reasonable interpretation of the statute. So the proposal before you brings the statute in Minnesota into line with Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in the Fielding case by adding an additional requirement that there be some minimum contacts with the state for a trust's non-source income, its investment income, to be taxable to Minnesota. It adopts the same administration standard that was adopted in 2005 to determine these pre-1996 trusts, whether a majority of the investment decisions were made here or a majority of the distribution decisions were made here. They look at the actual trustee activities and say, did they happen in the state of Minnesota? Okay, then there's enough connection to the state to justify taxing it. The difference is that for these post-95 trusts, if the person who created the trust wasn't a Minnesota person, banks, trust companies, family offices can continue to administer those trusts here, providing jobs for Minnesotans. There's a big industry here, without subjecting those trusts to tax in Minnesota. So if a bank has a trust that's created by somebody in Colorado and it's administered in their trust center here, it's not going to be taxable because the resident, the person who created it, wasn't a resident of Minnesota. That was the original purpose for this rule. Adding the administration standard simply makes it consistent with the Constitution and follows the Minnesota Supreme Court's requirements. And you don't have to be a constitutional scholar to file your taxes after this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions from the committee? Senator Ress, closing comments.
I think the testifier has explained it as well as any of us can understand it.
So. Senate File 2729 is laid over for possible thank inclusion.
Thank you.
Before the committee is Senate File 1062. Senator Rest, I believe you're presenting this on behalf of Senator West.
This one I understand. In the past, like in other parts of sales tax law, and in other areas of the dedicated appropriations as well, we have often, in order to understand the future obligations, we have required a prepayment of a future obligation. And that is the case in the in sales tax, we call it the June accelerated sales tax. And that means that when a taxpayer files their who are required, not all are, but are required to file monthly sales tax returns and to remit the tax, that they must also estimate the tax for the next month, which is then also collected and remitted. And then in July, when they file that return, which is now in the next fiscal year, they pay whatever is owing, and in the unlikely event that there is a refund, they would enjoy that. Currently, the accelerated sales tax, I believe, is Ms. Pollack, it's something like 87.5, is that right?
I think it's 84.5. It was 84.5 something.
Of the June's receipts needs to be included with the May payment. Previous bill, we have gotten rid of, when we've enjoyed a surplus, we have eliminated the June accelerated sales tax obligation and payment for most of the retail sales. One area of retail sales that we haven't eliminated has to do with liquor and tobacco and cigarette taxes. What Senator Westrom's bill, and I'm pleased to present it on his behalf, both myself and Senator Klein are co-authors, is to repeal, just like we've done for other retail sales, that accelerated payment for cigarettes and tobacco and alcohol without making judgments about whether we like those taxes or not. It's not the point of this bill. The you'll note if you look again at the revenue estimate, it's a lot of money in this first year. Getting rid of it is a is a hit, if you will, on the one-time surplus that we are enjoying. We know that the one-time money and the overall surplus is considerably more than what is available for tax relief and other spending purposes in the ongoing surplus. And it's, I mean, it's startling how much that one time it has an impact. It's $51 million in 2023. However, there are also residual effects that you'll see in the revenue impact in fiscal years 24, 25, and so on. So that is what the bill proposes, to bring all in the sales tax area, the to remove those three retail items from having to remit, of those taxpayers that have to remit monthly, of relieving them of that overburden. And I believe Mr. Bryant is here. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, which is a trade association of wholesalers that sell a number of different kinds of products to retail stores across the state, including cigarettes and tobacco products. Senate File 1062 will essentially reset the process that our state wholesalers follow to remit cigarette and tobacco taxes back to what I call normal. By normal, I mean that wholesalers would remit June's cigarette and tobacco tax collections to the state by July 18th. Usually, you remit each month's tax collections by the following 18th of the following month. Rather than, under current law, remitting both the May and 84.5% of June's estimated cigarette and tax liabilities by June 28th. Now, from the state's perspective, it'll still receive all the cigarette and tobacco tax revenue that's collected by wholesalers, but it'll just simply change that due date from June 28th to July 18th, about 3 weeks later. And that's important because, as you'll hear from the next testifier, Mike Smith, who is a wholesaler in St. Cloud, that three-week shift will eliminate the need for wholesalers to obtain a bank loan or extend a line of credit they have at their bank to pay the accelerated tax. Now, why do they have to get a loan? Because wholesalers generally sell cigarettes and tobacco products to their retail accounts on credit. They give them terms. They're due 2, 3, or 4 weeks in advance. So when they sell in June, they haven't collected the invoices from the retail stores yet. And without that collected invoice, they have to go to the bank, borrow the money to pay the tax, and then they have to pay the loan back in August, July or August, once they collect those invoices. So to eliminate that burden, as Senator Rest so eloquently put, to put it back to normal, we respectfully request that you support Senate File 1062. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bryan. And I believe online we have Mr. Mike Smith. Are you there?
Well, good morning.
Yes. Mr. Smith, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mike Smith. I'm a third-generation owner of Granite City Jobbing, which is a family wholesale distribution business located in St. Cloud. And Senate File 1062 is a welcome piece of legislation because it would repeal the accelerated cigarette and tobacco tax. I say welcome because as a wholesaler, my business remits the cigarette and tobacco taxes to the Department of Revenue by the 18th of each month for the prior month. However, in June, we must send in May's cigarette and tobacco tax of 84.5% of June's estimated excise tax. So we're essentially paying double in June because of June's liability would otherwise be paid in July. To pay June's excise tax liability early, we either have to borrow money from the bank or get a line of credit or somehow get those funds into the department, which is quite the burden. And like Tom was saying, many of our retail accounts are buying products on credit, so we've got outstanding receivables and just don't have the funds at the time to pay most of June's excise taxes in the month of June. So last June, our company paid almost $1 million in excise tax. In 2022, Minnesota's tobacco wholesalers paid $43.7 million in combined accelerated taxes to the state. When the accelerated taxes were first enacted some 25 years ago, the state had a budget deficit and required wholesalers to pay the excise tax 1 month early to help balance the budget. But now, with the historic high surplus, the reason for having the accelerated tax should no longer exist. Thank you for your time, and I urge you to support Senate Bill or Senate File 1062. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and members of the committee, questions or comments for the author or the testifiers? There are none. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a wonderful opportunity to do some catch up on with the position we find ourselves in with the one-time surplus dollars, and I hope we take advantage of it.
Senate File 1062 is laid over for possible inclusion. Senate File 2893 is in front of us. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I think we have fond, if not distant, memory now of passing the first conformity bill that brought Minnesota's tax law into conformity with the federal Internal Revenue Code from the middle of December. At that time, even though we had additional information about changes that were being made in the federal code up until quite recently, we did not include them in that bill. By passing it when we did, that $100 million was then added into the forecast, the February forecast, and we did not have to count that against anything that any additional actions of the legislature or the tax committee. So what Senate File 1062 does is to bring the conformity now up until March actions of the Senate of the federal government, and as it is researched by the Department of Revenue, would like to invite Ms. Byers, who is the legislative director, to come forward. I do understand that although this was not their initial proposal, that they are in support of it. Generally, I would like for you to look it over. Generally, if they're in a policy bill, which this would be part of, if there are objections, I wish you would raise them so that we can be aware of them as we are moving forward. But if you would then turn your attention to 2893, we'll have some testimony from Ms. Bears. And once again, there is a fiscal impact. These are not all of these changes are in the same area of the tax law. So they are a policy and just updating to the Internal Revenue Code. The impact in 2024, if you look at the chart that accompanies the revenue estimate on the third page, you can see where the revenue is raised by this conformity item, and where it and where there is tax relief. The and then the net effect of that in 2024 is $2.7 million revenue raised, and then the next 2 years, 3 years, it is switches, turns around, and is tax relief, and that often happens in updating various tax laws in Minnesota to the Internal Revenue Code. But I will then ask Ms. Bears to go through those sections, if you will, and most of them are affect individual taxpayers. So that's something we need to pay attention to.
Ms. Bears, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And we first want to say thank you to Chair Rest for authoring this bill today. As you all know, that Minnesota law relies on the federal definition of income in the calculation of state taxes, including exclusion, deductions, and other adjustments. So when there's a federal update, it helps us, it makes it clear for taxpayers which set tax rules apply when calculating income on their state return. And without a federal update, it becomes complicated for taxpayers to file because they have to make adjustments to their state income to account for these changes, which Minnesota has not yet conformed to. This SECURE Act here makes a couple changes to mostly retirement accounts. The first one is deferral for sales to stock, to employee stock ownership plans. There's changes for retirement account withdrawals for emergency expenses. Some other big ones are the charitable distributions for IRAs. It also makes changes for distributions for IRAs for federal disasters. And then it limits a deduction on charitable conservation easements. That's the one that does have a cost on the revenue estimate. If you note, there's an increase. There was some changes done at the federal level where they found some maybe abuse that was happening with that specific item. And so they made some changes to that.
Thank you, Ms. Bears. Questions or comments from the committee for the author or the testifier? There are none. Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is
Excuse me. Sorry, Senator Rest. Senator Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question.
Senator Nelson.
Tax liability, tax income. figured out what that means, but also I'm looking for, maybe it's going to be on the next page. So this is a revenue raiser. The others are, they are taxed, but this particular one is a revenue raiser. And how much does that increase the increased taxes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, if you look at the revenue estimate, it says it. In FY 2024, it's $4.2 million, and then it's reduced for the next three years.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Resk. And then my question is,
What exactly is, what does this mean? Not, you know, what's a deduction for a charitable conservation easement exactly? And then secondly, I see that the tax increase reduces over a number of years. And is that, why is that? So just a couple questions on that particular provision, if we could have a little bit of insight there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bayers or Senator Nagrest.
Before we turn to Ms. Bayers, if you would look at, again, at the explanation, I believe it's the lessening of the amount raised through this has impact as the three-year holding period requirement is met in time, and that's why it's going. That's why it goes down. And in the first year, that if I read the revenue estimate correctly, that that has an impact there that is not met by the three-year holding period. But Ms. Bayers can explain further if I misinformed you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, the limit for deduction for charitable conservation easement, that's a federal program that allows a deduction for people who may have an easement on their property for not developing it for conservation purposes. The reason there's an increase in cost is that they made some changes to that program because they found that folks were maybe getting more deductions than what was intended at the time this program was in place, and so they made some changes to not allow as many deductions for a charitable conservation easement. And that flows into our state income, or the, I think it flows into the income of the partnerships, and so that's how it affects us. Maybe Senate Counselor Ms. Pollack could explain a little bit more
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I wouldn't have anything more to add about the you know, concept of the provision for limiting the conservation easements. But if you think about it in the way that, so if we allow a deduction under current law and under, as it flows through to Minnesota from federal law, if that deduction is limited, in other words, you can't take as much of a deduction, so that will have the effect of raising some revenue for Minnesota state tax purposes.
Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just, and my question might be even more basic than all of that, just trying to understand the conservation easements. So if I wanted to not have an area developed behind my home and I chose to have an easement and said, well, this last, you know, half acre behind my house, I don't want to see any development, then I could make that a conservation easement or give that to a group. I'm not exactly sure what group that might be. Minnesota Land Trust might, I don't know if that's one. Then I could receive a tax deduction. Is that the gist of this?
Ms. Bayers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, yes.
Senator Nelson.
That answered my question. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. We'll have more conversations about conservation easements in a couple of days. So look forward to that. Mr. Hilgard's smiling at me. He's not crazy about my bill. I had a question, Mr. Chair, for the author or for Ms. Bayers, about charitable distributions from IRAs. You know, the short version is this allows for one-time charitable distribution of up to $50,000 and adds inflation indexing to the annual $100,000 limit. But the key phrase I see in the revenue note is that the provision will reduce taxable income. And if you recall my Senate File 1631, where my constituent was forced to add that income back for the purposes of calculating her property tax refund, I'm wondering if this provision makes my bill moot or not. You don't have to figure that out today, but something might, we might want to look into. Right. Thanks.
Ms. Bayers or Senator Rust?
I appreciate you raising the question. I don't have a particular answer for it. They have, over the years, however, there's been changes to the ability to make direct charitable contributions from an IRA that, although it counts as part of the required minimum distribution, you don't, unlike other distributions, you don't add it to income and then on their on your tax return take a charitable deduction. It's done, never, those transfers never go, never touch the hands of the giver, and it goes right from the IRAs into to the recipient, the beneficiary of the of the gift. And occasionally, because of circumstances, there are changes that are made to those provisions, and more is allowed on some occasions than others based on what's happening in the economy or disasters or things where something is allowed to be, to exceed the limit that is removed from the IRA, and I don't know the specific circumstances that caused this particular change in the distributions for those particular charitable entities. You know, you can't do this in terms of giving it to a church or something. But these are, again, very complicated instruments, probably used by mostly very wealthy people.
Senator Dibble?
I'll have conversations with council. We'll figure out if my bill is now moot or not. Thanks.
Senator Dibble, any further questions or comments from the committee? Senator Rust?
Thank you very much. I have one slight confession to make. I forgot my hearing aids. And so I hope that my responses to your questions were actually made sense to you. Tried my best. I'm not very good at lip reading, but I do appreciate your indulgence. I just forgot them.
Senate File 2893 is laid over for possible inclusion. Before we adjourn, are there any announcements?
No, I would like to speak with DFLers on the committee just out there for a minute, if you will, after we adjourn.
Senate Tax Committee is adjourned.